We've started a series called God and the Skeptics. You see the church advertisement there. Series called God and the Skeptics. The first part are seven skeptical doubts. We're looking at the third one. And it is this doubt: Christianity is a straitjacket. To help us understand what they mean by such an accusation, defining the argument, four charges against Christianity. Here's a couple of quotes. Christians believe that they have the absolute truth that everyone else has to believe or else, said Keith, the young artist living in Brooklyn. That attitude endangers everyone's freedom. Yes, agreed Chloe, another young artist. A one-truth-fits-all approach is just too confining. The Christians I know don't seem to have the freedom to think for themselves. I believe each individual must determine truth for him or herself. These, again, are quotes from an email survey of young New Yorkers in their mid-20s by Timothy Keller and Nicole Diamond Austin, who collects last names for whatever reason. So four charges against Christianity. Let's just look at them briefly and then try to give some answers. First of all, asking the question, is a belief in absolute truth the enemy of freedom? The charge is Christianity names some beliefs as heresy and some practices as immoral. This leads to the charge that since Christianity holds to absolute truth, it endangers personal freedom. Secondly, the church bars from its community those who transgress its doctrinal and moral boundaries. To contemporary observers, this endangers civic freedom because it divides rather than unites our population. So this leads to the charge that Christianity restricts community. Communism. Thirdly, it also appears to be culturally narrow, failing to recognize that various cultures have different perspectives on reality. Reincarnation, transmigration of the soul, and so on. This leads to the charge that Christianity demands all cultures bow to its own. And finally, it seems to enslave, or at least infantilize its members, determining what they must believe, what they must practice in every particular. This leads to the charge that Christianity limits intellectual freedom. Well, debating the argument, let's look at four truths supporting Christianity. And if you are able to get your mind around these thoughts, this will put you in pretty good stead as you deal with people who have bought in unthinkingly to the liberal skeptical line and are parroting the very things that they've heard before. The first thing is about truth. The fact is, truth is unavoidable. Just because you're a skeptic, it doesn't mean you don't have to answer the question about truth. The charge that since Christianity holds to absolute truth, it endangers personal freedom, actually presupposes the postmodernist philosophy that says there is no one truth, that there are many different truths, and you pretty well come up with it on your own. The French philosopher Michel Foucault, October 15, 1926 to June 25, 1984, writes in an article, Truth and Power, in a book called Power, Knowledge, Selected Interviews and Other Writings. Truth, here's what he wrote. Truth is a thing of this world. It is produced only by multiple forms of constraint, and that includes the regular effects of power. In other words, those in authority tell us what they want us to believe and call it truth. Following his thought, many allege that any claim to truth, that if I claim I have the truth, that is really a power play, an attempt to control others. Well, let's look at his argument, because it fails, because it condemns itself. It's one of those self-condemning prophecies. If Foucault claims that what he says is true, which is why he said it, right, he must be trying to control us. The attitude that you can explain everything away eventually explains away your explanation. Does that explain it? Did I say explain enough? C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Abolition of Man, explains it this way. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent because the street or garden beyond the window is opaque. How if you saw through the garden too? To see through all things is the same as not to see. This is where you seem to be able to see through everyone's argument. Sigmund Freud, for instance, claimed that all truth claims about religion and God were psychological projections to deal with guilt and insecurity. Sounds quite psychological. If he were correct, if he were making a truth claim, then we must assume it was to cover his own guilt and insecurity. We take his argument, apply it to himself. So even an unbeliever in God who tries to work against oppression of others, the liberal mindset that hates to see slavery in other lands, hates to see the oppression of women, of children, of the poor, an unbeliever who tries to work against oppression of others must assume some kind of truth that applies to others, but that truth is something outside of himself. So he is in the position of trying to correct others. He wants to change others to his point of view. G.K. Chesterton, in his book Orthodoxy, The Romance of Faith, said this, "For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind." If you are denouncing, on what platform, on what basis are you denouncing? You have then a moral doctrine of some kind. By rebelling against everything, he has lost his right to rebel against anything. So you rebel against everything, then nothing is true, so why are you arguing? Doesn't make any difference. So the first truth supporting Christianity is that truth is unavoidable. Wherever you are, whatever you believe, you hold to some concept of a truth, and you're trying to get others to agree with you. Why should Christianity be any different? Secondly, community cannot be completely inclusive, all inclusive. You can't have that. It defies the concept of community. The charge that Christianity restricts community, that fails because no community, whether religious or secular, can exist without some kind of restriction. It's a foolish argument to insist that human communities should be completely inclusive, open to all on the basis of our common humanity. I say it's foolish. Why is it foolish? because this is an oversimplification to the extreme. Because all communities are based on certain presuppositions that we have gathered because we together believe certain things. The most liberal democracy gives a preference to the individual rights over community rights. If you're a very liberal democracy, your individual rights count more than community rights. It also divides private from public morality. So they say whatever you do behind your own doors doesn't matter. It's up to you. And it also makes personal choice a most holy thing. Yet a little thought shows that these assumptions are actually foreign to many other cultures. Not everybody agrees with individual over community rights, private over public morality, personal choice being the most important thing. So, this community, this liberal democracy, has assumed certain things to be true, and they commune on the basis of a presupposition of those thoughts. So some may say that Western society is based on a shared commitment to reason, to rights, and to justice. Yet even these ideas are not universally defined in the same way. When you get down to it and ask people about rights and about justice, they are perceived in the context of some particular set of beliefs about the meaning of human life. What do the justice in some of the Arab countries is whacking off the hand of a thief. We would find that to be, what, a little extreme? Speaking offhandedly. No. This you have to take this in regard to the culture. So this is not all inclusive, even with this definition. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Or other people that we meet, we have common money and we have common language and we think everybody has the right to make their own decisions and all that.
Right.
Okay. If we went then into Europe, we might find a different set of beliefs. We might behave differently because we know it's their culture and we're the foreigner.
Right. And if you go to India, or maybe parts of India, you go to various areas of Asia. You go to a tribe in South America. And you try to say, we all are together because we all agree on this. And they're saying, we don't agree with that at all. So even what seems to us or to in the modern United States, it seems to be, we have an all-inclusive attitude. It doesn't include everybody. That's oversimplification. So, since every person, especially those from diverse backgrounds, must have different sets of beliefs, no community can exist that includes everybody equally. Here's an example, an imaginary one. But imagine two associations with very different purposes. So someone on the board of the Gay and Lesbian Rights Task Force announces, the board member stands up, I have had a religious awakening. I now believe homosexuality to be a sin. He's a board member on the Gay and Lesbian Rights. And across the city, the board of the Alliance Against Same-Sex Marriage meets. and a board member announces, "I discovered my son is gay. I now believe that he has the right to marry his partner." So you have a board member on these two things. Now, generally speaking, people think that the gay and lesbian, they're very inclusive. They're not trying to exclude anybody. But guess who they would exclude? See, the guy who says now homosexuality is a sin. He's out, see. And the guy who says now I believe in homosexual marriage, he's out of the Alliance Against Same-Sex Marriage. So wherever you are, you see, whatever community you're putting together, both of these who now think differently must eventually be excluded from the board because they reject the group's basic values. So no matter what community you're talking about, you can't have one that includes everybody. You would have to have a group called Everybody Group, Everybody Club. And it wouldn't mean anything. It would have no corporate identity. You know, we're for this. No, you can't do that because you'd have to be for everything or not against anything or something. So that's just like, I guess, by automatic, where everybody's a member of the Everybody Club. Automatically. We don't have meetings. We can't have meetings. You know, that would restrict. It doesn't make any sense. There's a better way. There's a better way to determine if a community is open and caring or narrow and oppressive. Here's two questions. Ask, which community has beliefs that lead its members to treat persons in other communities with love and respect? I was asked today at the Magician's Luncheon, as a Baptist preacher, what was my attitude toward one of our members who does some cross-dressing for his performances? And I said, well, you know, I'm not so much about what a person does once and again. I find that this man is altogether a decent person. He's a loving husband. They don't have children, but a loving husband dedicated to his wife. He espouses a philosophy that he can't live with. So he's a decent person, though he puts on the mask of that cross-dressing transgender thing, see. And this pretty much because of experiences that he's had in the past, but that's not who he is. So I really have no problem with him as a person. I have a problem with almost everything that he says he believes, but not with him as a person. So the question is, which community has beliefs that lead its members to treat persons in other communities with love and respect? I'd say maybe Christianity would be one. Then ask again, which community's beliefs lead it to demonize and attack those who violate its boundaries? If Christians condemn unbelievers and treat them in an ungracious way, we begin to realize that this is not the way God dealt with us as sinners. Why are we dealing with people like that, you see? The simple fact of maintaining standards in accord with Christian beliefs should not be criticized. Every community will hold to its own basic core values. A third, and you had a comment. That's true.
Even if you traveled as fast as you could,
you
could never,
I
see you.
I want to see the roster on that one, Cliff. Yeah. What's the point? See, what's the point of calling it that? All right, the third. Christianity is not culturally rigid. A foolish, foolish argument. There was perhaps a time when England first sent out missionaries that they were just as concerned about spreading English culture as they were concerned with spreading Christianity. That time is no more. In fact, Christianity has been more adaptive and less destructive to diverse cultures than other religions and even secularism itself. Consider the beginnings of Christianity. It began in Palestine with Jews. It moved to Europe, became dominated by the Hellenistic people centered in the Mediterranean. Later it moved to Western Europe and North America. Today, by statistics, most Christians in the world live in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Lamin Sane, in his book, Whose Religion is Christianity, revealed that in 1900, 9% of Africans were Christians, and four times that were Muslim. In the 1960s, Christianity passed Islam in number. Today, Christians comprise 44% of the population. This explosive growth is now being seen in China. It is estimated that in 30 years, 30% of the 1.5 billion Chinese will be Christians. Whether they'll be persecuted and so on, or whether that will sway the government, yet to be seen. As Christianity enters a culture, it does make some demands, but these are demands of righteousness. But it allows the church to develop naturally. African churches, the Philippine churches, and the American churches are all very different. But they maintain the same core beliefs. To say that we're making people bow to our culture is to misunderstand Christianity. Christianity doesn't have a culture. It adapts to all the cultures. Historian Alice Walls wrote, "Cultural diversity was built into the Christian faith in Acts 15, which declared that the new Gentile Christians didn't have to enter Jewish culture. The converts had to work out a Hellenistic way of being a Christian. So no one owns the Christian faith. There is no Christian culture the way there is an Islamic culture, which you can recognize from Pakistan to Tunisia to Morocco." Tunisia, the land of the Tunises. But you find, you go from one place to the other, pretty much lockstep culture, because the religion dictates it, not so Christianity. And consider this, the ideal earthly kingdom will exist during the millennium. Isaiah chapter 60 and Revelation 21 and 22 show us that the people of earth under that kingdom will retain their cultural differences during that time. Revelation 21, 24, and the nations, these diverse nations of them which are saved, shall walk in the light of it, of the New Jerusalem. And the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it. So you have diverse areas, kings, nations. If it were all homogenous, there would be one nation, see? But diverse nations, diverse kings, all serving the one King of Kings. Well, then finally, freedom is not simply a lack of constraint. Freedom is not letting me do anything I want. That's not freedom. Early 20th century social activist Emma Goldman called Christianity the leveler of the human race, the breaker of man's will to dare and to do, an iron net, a straitjacket which does not let him expand or grow. We see this reflected in a number of ways. At the end of the movie iRobot, 2004, the robot named Sonny has fulfilled the objectives in his design program. Now he realizes that he no longer has a purpose. The movie concludes with a dialogue between Sonny and the other main character, Detective Spooner. Sonny, now that I have fulfilled my purpose, I don't know what to do. Detective Spooner, I guess you'll have to find your way like the rest of us, Sonny. That's what it means to be free. You have no direction. Just make up something.
And doesn't he go kind of like an evangelist to all those rejected ones out there?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Our Supreme Court has enshrined this view in law when it gave the opinion, the heart of liberty is to, quote, define one's own concept of existence, of the meaning of the universe. Evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould concurs, we are here because one odd group of fishes had a particular fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Just happened. Because comets struck the earth and wiped out dinosaurs, thereby giving mammals a chance not otherwise available. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We cannot read the meaning of life passively in the facts of nature. We must construct these answers for ourselves. This is where the world is today. So in this view, freedom means there is no overall purpose for which we were created. Because if there was, we would be obligated to be conformed to it. We would be obligated to fulfill that purpose. And that would be limiting. So this attitude of freedom, this doctrine of freedom, says you cannot have a purpose for your life. You just come up with one. Sitting on rocks, that would be your purpose in life because you came up with it. This philosophy preaches that true freedom is freedom to create your own meaning and purpose. You know, we take this to its ridiculous end, and that is, I believe that I'm underwater and that you are images of fish that I talk to. So now I'm going to try to live my life on that basis. The whole thing's ridiculous. I don't have to wear scuba gear because I breathe water like fish, you know. So you just make stuff up. That's your own purpose. And what is it really? It's a resistance to authority. Anybody telling me what to do. Anybody telling me what I'm about. And this resistance to authority in moral matters runs very deep now in our culture. Freedom to determine our own moral standards is considered a necessity for being human. But do we want the person, the drug addict, the murderer, the person who thinks he's the next step of evolution, he's the predator, we're the predatee, what? The prey. Do we want him to have the complete freedom to just make his own morality? Are we going to be happy with that? The charge that Christianity limits intellectual freedom fails because it does not admit that freedom cannot be defined in strictly negative terms. Freedom is more than merely the absence of confinement, the absence of constraint. True freedom often involves a form of restriction. When a person learns to play a musical instrument, he cannot play beautifully in freedom until he's given many hours of restriction to practice. You say, I right now, playing the piano, I have complete freedom. But it sounds horrible because I don't know how to play. But I'm not restricted at all, see. Just no good. My wife, having restricted over the years, now can sit and find dots on a page meaning something to her and can play. And now she has the freedom to make this happen, but only at the restriction of many years and hours of practice. An accomplished sports person has dedicated himself to many hours of training. There's another part of this freedom. It includes what's natural to the person. Dave and I are never going to be linemen for the NFL. You know, it's just not going to happen. We might become puddles for the feet of the people opposing us, but we're not big enough for that. No matter how long we would train. Or the fish who conceives he wants to be free to travel the world, you know. But he will find true freedom only within the restriction of his watery world. So with man, freedom is not so much the absence of restrictions as it is finding the right restrictions. Restrictions that fit our nature and our world can produce the greatest freedom. Here's the way to think about it. Christianity was given to man by God. God knows all reality. God knows better than we know ourselves because he created us. Therefore, when he sets before us restrictions of life, he is setting us free. Here's the key thought. Our freedom is not the ability to do whatever we want. It is the freedom to be able to do what we should. So many people in the world today seem to have the freedom to do anything they want. And they're miserable because they can't get away from the bad things that they do. We were praying for a young man who can't control his temper. And he runs the risk of being a danger to himself and others. Or even his job security at risk because he can't control this, you see. This isn't freedom, that's bondage. This is the rewarding freedom that brings true joy. So when a skeptic says, every person has a right to define, has to define right and wrong for himself, the believer's question should be, is there anyone in the world right now doing things you believe they should stop doing, no matter how they justify it, no matter what they personally believe about the correctness of their behavior? Do you think anybody's doing bad stuff and they ought to stop? Well, sure. I mean, you think about the people of Nigeria stealing those girls. Generally, we say that was a bad thing. They should stop doing that. But what if they want to? What if they've defined right and wrong, where they get a lot of money for stealing these girls? Maybe it's right for them. No, it's just wrong. You see, honesty should compel them to admit that they would like to stop some people from certain actions. And then your response could be, doesn't that mean that you believe there is some kind of moral reality that is not defined by us, how we feel, what we think. A moral reality that must be abided by regardless of what a person feels or thinks. Do you realize that's the way you really live? You can't live with the idea that everybody can make up their own thing. You can say that, but you can't live like that. That doesn't fit reality. All right. Think of this. Christianity is summarized by love. Love, while extremely liberating, includes voluntary self-restrictions. Since love is concerned with meeting the needs of the loved one, even if it demands personal sacrifice, true love demands the loss of some independence. To gain the freedom of love, you must limit your freedom in several ways. A loving husband no longer makes decisions about his evenings without considering the needs and wishes of his wife. That wouldn't be loving. He could do that, but it wouldn't be loving. To experience the freedom of love, you must give up some of your personal autonomy. A loving couple will experience a mutual loss of independence as they rely on each other more. Now, within Christianity, at first sight, the believer's relationship to God seems to be one where the believer does all the adjusting, while the perfect God does not adjust for the believer at all. This is not the real situation. In fact, the stunning concept of Christianity is what God did to adjust for us. In the most radical way, God has adjusted to us. God reached into humanity, his creation, with his son Jesus, and had him and he volunteered to become flesh. On the cross, Jesus submitted to our condition, and he died in our place as a payment for our sin. God, through Christ, said, "I will adjust to you. I will change for you. I'll serve your needs, even though it demands a terrible sacrifice from me." So, the freedom that comes from love is not a freedom to do what you want, but a limiting of yourself to do what is needed by the loved one. All right, comments or questions? The idea that Christianity is a straitjacket, it is that which releases from the bondage of sin. Bondage of the mind, bondage of the flesh. Yes, sir?
Yeah, it's ultimate dishonesty on their part about accusing us of being restrictive and judgmental.
Yeah. It's because they want to do what they want to do. And we say, you shouldn't do that. So now, you're restricting me. We see this with every little kid that grows up. No, don't pick up that butcher knife. You're restricting my personality, you know. Yes.
Every time you talk to these guys, eventually they will say the words, "I don't like being told what to do."
Yes, that's the essence of it. Right there. So they have no real argument. Christianity is not a straitjacket, but rather an opportunity to understand true freedom.